This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime, from BBC Radio 4, with me, Lucy Worsley. We're taking a look, yes, a feminist look, at the wild and unthinkable crimes supposedly committed by different murderesses in Victorian Britain, North America and beyond. Why did these women do it? The answer lies in the world in which they lived. I want to take you on a journey into the romantic life of a young Victorian woman.
My dearest Emile, I shall keep your letter and press it in my bosom. My fond Emile, are you well? I am longing so to see you, my sweet pet, to kiss and pet you. Oh, for the day when I can do so at any time. I fear we shall spoil each other when we are married. We shall love each other so. How we shall enjoy that time when we have no one to disturb us in your little room.
Whoa, well, that's a different and racier start than normal to our programme. Today, we're looking at romance turned toxic. With me in the studio is Denise Miner, an award-winning crime author. And joining us in a bit will be our resident historian, Rosalind Crone. Denise, this case happened in your neck of the woods, didn't it?
It did. It happened in Glasgow, but at a really interesting point in Glasgow's history. It's becoming incredibly rich and it becomes the second city of the empire during this period.
And we went up to Scotland to see for ourselves where our teenage lady killer lived. Transport yourself back to Glasgow of the 1850s. And I'm talking about the posh part of the city, Socky Hall Street, where I'm standing just now, the shopping area, where people would have been bustling off to balls, to concerts, to exhibitions, to parties, or just going to the shops. And I want to introduce you to somebody who loved all of this stuff, Madeline Smith. She was one of five children of well-to-do parents. She'd been to finishing school in London, and by her late teens, she was back in Glasgow, just waiting to get married, basically. Now, you might have the wrong idea about what the life would be like of a young, upper-middle-class woman like this. You might think it was super controlled, that she'd have a strict Victorian dad sort of keeping her locked up to keep her pure for marriage. Not the case. Madeline was allowed to be a real party animal. She writes of never being in bed before 2 or 3 in the morning and all day long going about. She did do some of the things you might expect that a prim Victorian miss would do, like music and drawing. But she and her sister actually spent a lot of the time promenading, as they called it. This means, essentially, strutting about the streets of Glasgow without a chaperone. Really quite racy. These girls like to have fun. And it was on the streets of Glasgow, possibly even this street, Socky Hall Street, that Madeline Smith met our love interest, a tasty young man called Pierre-Emile Longelier. But it was at this point when Madeline met Pierre-Emile that her life took a terribly wrong turning. Now, there's a bit of disagreement in the sources as to whether it was actually on the streets of Glasgow or in a draper's shop. But either way, they met and began a secret correspondence.
My dear Emile, I do not feel as if I were writing you for the first time. Though our intercourse has been very short, yet we have become as familiar friends. May we long continue so. And ere long may you be a friend of Papa's, is my most earnest desire.
These are Madeline's own words, recounting her experience of meeting Pierre-Emile Longelier. He was from Jersey.
And that was just the first letter of many. I'm going to have a look at some more of them with Roz.
Okay, we're being quite quiet because we're in a reading room. We've come to the Mitchell Library in Glasgow to visit the special collections department. And here they've got some very special letters. Here they are.
There we go.
We've come a long way to see these. What we're looking at is a handful of about 250 letters written in secret by Madeline Smith to her secret lover. His name is Pierre-Emile Langelier. Oh, look, they've got out a photo of him for us. Doesn't he look soulful and dreamy and romantic? He's got hipster hair. He's gazing off into the distance in his photo. The thing is, he's inappropriate for her, isn't he? Because he's from a much lower social class.
Yeah, that's right. So Emile was a warehouse clerk in Glasgow.
So they met, something electrical happened, and they struck up this clandestine correspondence, and ever so many of her letters to him survive because they were used as evidence in her trial. What did she do? Get rid of his letters? Were they dangerous for her to keep?
Yeah, that's right. So she burned his letters because she didn't want them lying around the house and perhaps someone to discover them.
So in this box of letters, we've just got the most amazing insight into the mind of a girl on the cusp of adult life in the 19th century. The letters are... they're such cute little objects because the envelopes are so tiny, aren't they? What's that, twice the size of a credit card?
Yeah, yes.
Now, I have to say this is not the easiest handwriting to read. And it's deceptive because it's so neat. Oh, no, look here on this page. She's gone left to right and then she's gone up and down as well.
Yeah, it's writing over writing and it makes it extremely hard to decipher.
That's to get maximum value out of the paper. Yeah.
So they've started writing to each other, which is a very naughty thing for a young, upper-middle-class woman to do. But as you'll hear, things get even naughtier.
Dearest Emile, all this day I have wished for one moment to kiss you. To lay my head on your breast would make me so happy. Oh, to hear you again, speak to me, call me your wife, and tell me you love me. Can you wonder that I feel happy? Much, much love, tender. Long embraces, kisses, love. I am thy own, thy ever fond, thy own dear loving wife, thy Mimi Langelier.
Wow, she's literally signing off using his last name. Back at the Mitchell Library with Roz, we see that she refers to wife and husband quite a lot. Is this just playing around, or is it actually something more serious?
It does indicate that there's some kind of promise of marriage there between them. In Scotland in this period, of course, people married in church in a very formal way, but there was also something called common law marriage. Mm. So if you had promised yourselves to each other, if you engaged in activities that married couples would engage in, for example, sexual intercourse, and if you went about in public as if you were married, then you could legally be said to be married. But in this case, they're keeping this all very, very secret.
This is a fantasy relationship then, possibly. I mean, she sort of knows that she can't marry him and that she's got to marry somebody that her family have picked out from an appropriate social class, do you think?
I think she has so much to lose, really, in marrying him, while he has everything to gain.
Okay? And he must be so happy that she's writing to him, Emile, perhaps I did wrong in taking you into my room, but are you not my own husband?
Yeah, so they do escalate the relationship. It's far more than just meeting up occasionally in public. It's far more than lovely platitudes and declarations
of
love and letters.
How far did they go then?
Well, they went the whole hog.
What's the evidence for that?
It's in the letters, which is amazing. That's why the letters were just so explosive at the time, revealing a relationship between two people who are not suitably matched. But more than that, they're revealing premarital sex. Now, we know that the Victorians engaged in premarital sex, but in this class, not so much.
We don't often see them at it, do we?
No, they certainly didn't talk about it.
Goodness me. Well, I'm sorry to lower the tone here, but take me to that letter. Where's the smoking gun that they did actually engage in intercourse?
Apparently, it was on the evening of the 6th of June, 1856, they did the deed. And she wrote to him afterwards in quite explicit language.
My own beloved husband, thank you, my love, for coming so far to see your Mimi. It is truly a pleasure to see my Emile. I did not bleed last night, but a good deal of pain during the night. Beloved, if we did wrong last night, it must have been in the excitement of our love. Yes, beloved, I did truly love you with my soul. I was happy. It was a pleasure to be with you. Oh, if we could have remained never more to have parted. But we must hope the time shall come.
Ooh, Denise, this is very steamy stuff, isn't it?
Are we really surprised that Victorian teenagers were having sex with each other?
I'm surprised.
Are you?
Yes.
Just because it's not documented. And of course, we always think of later Victorian constructions of sexuality, which are very prudish. But of course they were having sex. And if these people were working class and this was documented, we wouldn't be shocked. But it's that construction of upper middle class people as utterly sexless that makes this shocking.
I agree with you, Denise, in that there probably was more premarital sex going on than we think. But it was risky because marriages in this class were economic alliances. And men wanted to be sure that their money and assets would pass to their children and not to another man's.
I don't know what to think about this. Am I happy for her? I can't work out what the power balance between them is. Obviously, she's richer than him, but he's older. Do you think this relationship is healthy?
I think it's so interesting that, you know, romance novels of this period always have transgressive love affairs that cross boundaries, that cross class. What she's doing is basically living out a kind of romance novel that she may have read at finishing school.
Yes, well, not necessarily a sensible way to live your life. What do you think he was going through? What do you think he would have said if we had access to his side of the story?
I think from his point of view, he's probably seeing someone very rich. He's clearly quite grandiose and he quite fancies himself marrying up. He is keeping her letters. She's burning his. And I think that speaks fundamentally to the power imbalance between them. He's keeping evidence. It's revenge porn, these letters, isn't it, really?
Ooh, yes, it's revenge porn, isn't it? And Roz, do you know what his thoughts were on this? Or were they lost like his other letters are?
We do actually have a draft of the letter Emile sent to Madeleine after they had consummated the relationship, which suggests that he must have written it a few times before actually sending it. Here it is. My dearest and beloved wife, Mimi.
Since I saw you, I have been wretchedly sad. Would to God, had we not met that night, I would have been happier. I am sad at what we did. I regret it very much. We did wrong. God forgive us for it, Mimi. We have loved blindly. Why, Mimi, did you give way after your promises? I was not angry at your allowing me, Mimi, but I am sad it happened. You had no resolution. We should indeed have waited until we were married, Mimi. It was very bad indeed. I shall look with regret on that night.
Now, he's saying that it was bad that she had given herself to him. He's regretting. Well, he's saying that he's regretting the sexual intimacy that they'd had. And one question that really immediately comes to mind is how on earth did they manage it? I mean, where did they go, Roz? Where did people sneak off in 19th century Glasgow to explore their bodies?
Well, increasing physical intimacy between this couple seems to have begun in the winter of 1855 when the Smith family were resident in town. And that intimacy continued when the family went to their country house for the summer of 1856. Emile would travel up to the house, and here, this seems to be where they began to have sex, outside in the garden.
And this wasn't uncommon, presumably, in an age when housing was generally more crowded, where privacy was less available than it is to us today.
That's right. We often think about overcrowding working-class dwellings, but even the homes of the middle and the upper middle class, these were busy places full of servants and visitors. So illicit sexual liaisons were carried on outdoors.
So walking down the street at night in Victorian Britain might have been quite a noisy experience from what you're saying. What do we think at this stage, Denise and Roz? Is he a goodie or a baddie?
Well, look at what he says in his draft letter. You had no resolution. And he's very much using that construction of she's responsible for his sexuality. So although he doesn't have money and she does have money, he is 10 years older and he is a man. So it's a very complex interweaving kind of power dynamic that's going on and is shifting all the time.
And what do you think, Roz? Is this fantasy on her part? Is it boredom on her part? What's your view?
Historians have come to quite different conclusions on this. So if we look at Mary Hartman, who was writing back in the 1970s, who was reading a selection of Madeline's letters that had been transcribed for trials, so pulled out in order to prosecute her, she saw Madeline as this silly, bored teenager who read too much romantic fiction, was kind of playing out her fantasy and using Emile. However, more recently, Eleanor Gordon and Gwyneth Nair, who read all the letters, all 250, including all of those that were not transcribed for trial, came away with a very different impression of a girl who was besotted by this older man, and the man being a social climber who liked to exert his control over her.
So we've got to be careful not to be swayed by the picture of Madeline that was painted in her trial. We should look at all of the evidence, and we might reach a very different conclusion about who she was and what she was up to. But Madeline is soon brought back to reality. Her father has arranged a marriage for her with an appropriate suitor. Our social butterfly Madeline gets engaged in 1857 to William Minnock. Now, he's vitally a man approved by her family. So now she starts panicking about her secret love affair with Emile. She tries to break up with him and to get back her letters. It's time for her to forget all about that and to do her duty as a daughter.
I felt truly astonished to have my last letter returned to me. But it will be the last. Then our correspondences shall be at an end. And as there is coolness on both sides, our engagement had better be broken. Owing to coolness and indifference, the way better for the future, consider ourselves strangers. I trust to your honour as a gentleman that you will not reveal anything that may have passed between us. I shall feel obliged by your bringing me my letters and likeness on Thursday evening at 7. On Friday night, I shall send you all your letters and likeness, etc. I trust that you may yet be happy and get one more worthy of you than I. On Thursday at 7 o'clock.
But this doesn't work. He doesn't return the letters. In fact, he threatens to do something much worse.
Emile, for God's sake, do not send my letters to Papa. It will be an open rupture. I will leave the house. I will die. Emile, do nothing till I see you. One word tomorrow night at my window to tell me, or I shall go mad. Emile, you did love me. I did fondly, truly love you too. Oh, dear Emile, be not so harsh to me. One word, and on Wednesday we meet. Oh, Emile, do nothing.
Have they reconciled, or is Madeline stringing him along here to buy some time? After all, she's still betrothed to William Minnock. Despite all of that, she still plans one more late-night rendezvous by her window in the hope that Emile will come.
Why, my beloved, did you not come to me? Sweet one, I waited and waited for you, but you came not. I shall wait again tomorrow night. Same hour and arrangement. Oh, come, beloved, and clasp me to your heart. Come, and we shall be happy. A kiss, fond love. Adieu with tender embraces. Ever believe me to be your own ever dear, fond Mimi.
It seems that Madeline's plea for one last meeting may have worked, because on the fateful night of the 22nd of March, 1857, Emile goes out, and when he comes home, he's unwell. His landlady calls a doctor, but it's no good. Emile dies. His sudden and mysterious death means a post-mortem, and this reveals he's been poisoned by arsenic. One of Emile's supervisors at work finds letters from Madeline in his desk and hands them in to the authorities. Madeline, meanwhile, attempts to flee from her family home in Glasgow. But did she actually meet Emile on the night in question? And if she did, what happened? Let's go to the scene of the alleged crime. And Denise joins us there too. It's the Grand Corner House in an impressive Georgian street, number 7, Blythewood Square, Glasgow. So let's work out which part of the house Madeline occupied. Roz has brought along a plan of the house, haven't you, Roz? Let's
have a look. Now, we have two floors on the plan, and you can see kitchen.
Yes.
Madeline's room was located just behind the kitchen, so on the lower ground floor of the house.
So
We know that sometimes Pierre-Emile would visit her in her room. Do we imagine he would have come through the area in the servants' entrance next to the kitchen and then into her room like that?
That's possible. It sounds rather complicated, and that certainly, I think, would have required a bit of help from a servant. An alternative might be she has two external windows in her bedroom. Could you have smuggled someone in a window?
Are those windows still there? Should we go and see?
Yep.
This is her bedroom window.
I think this is her bedroom window.
It's right on the street.
It's right on the footpath. And it's quite a size. I could fit through there.
Oh, my goodness.
Three of us could fit through there simultaneously.
Yes.
It's enormous.
This is very definitely a breach in the defences of the Smith family. I mean, their girl is completely accessible to the world through her bedroom window. So what's the evidence for what actually happened on the night? The fatal night when she's supposed to have given him the poison.
Well, there are two versions. There's the formal one in the trial, and there's the oral tradition of Glasgow. The oral tradition in Glasgow is she opened this window in her bedroom and handed out a glass of cocoa with arsenic in it. The formal story happens round the corner, and it's quite interesting. It's that, should we go round? The unlikely story is, and this is the prosecution's case, is that she made the poisoned arsenic in the kitchen in front of everybody. She walks out to the street where she would know people. She comes to the steps. She meets him here. She gives him the arsenic here. And that's very unlikely that she would do that. It's much more discreet to just hand it out the window. So I think the oral version of the story is much more likely. You very often find this in true crime cases, is that the version that was told in the press and in the court is convoluted, complicated, and serves other purposes. But actually, when people empathise with the person involved in the crime, you would just hand it out the window.
So it's unclear how Madeleine gave Emile the poisoned cocoa. That's if she did. But was there anything else presented in the trial to indicate whether she really was guilty or not? In front of us now is a picture of a poison register. It belonged to John Curry, a local druggist in Glasgow. Ros, what exactly is a poison register?
This kind of record keeping was a consequence of the 1851 Sale of Arsenic Act. Basically, there had in the 1840s been a spate of poisonings by arsenic, and so legislation was passed that required names of purchasers to be entered into a register by the chemist so the potential murderers could be traced if the arsenic was used for nefarious purposes.
And here we've got the 21st of February, name of purchaser, Miss Smith, purchaser's address, 7 Blyveswood Square, where we've just been, and purpose for which required. So she wrote in the register at the time that she was buying it for gardening, but in her trial, she changed her story and said, no, actually, I bought it to improve my complexion. You'd think that if you were going to murder somebody, you wouldn't put your name in the poison register. That links you to the purchase of the murder weapon.
Yeah, well, in this case, it would have been purchased on account. I mean, young upper middle class ladies would not have gone about carrying money.
Have we considered that she wasn't a mastermind and she was just a bit of an idiot?
And doing one thing and then another
and
not really thinking it through.
And she thought, she bought this stuff and, you know, maybe she did want to use it for her complexion, meaning to use it for that. And then you would panic and you would think, oh, God, this man's got all these letters. And she is 19. Let's remember that.
All of this circumstantial evidence, the letters, the purchase of the arsenic, this is used at Madeleine Smith's trial to try to convince the jury that she's guilty. But Madeleine has other things going for her. She's young, she's beautiful, she's wealthy, and she's part of Scotland's upper middle classes. Some of the media are very happy to see her as a sort of tragic heroine who's almost the victim here.
She wrote him certain letters, letters characterised by a warmth of feeling and an intensity of devotion. She put her honour in the palm of his hand. She hung her maiden garland round his neck. The man, Langelier, was not worthy of the trust reposed in him. He threatened to show her letters and to denounce her shame to her father. A threat dishonourable, mean, and villainous.
That's from the Daily Telegraph, which clearly sympathises with Madeleine. Not all the papers do, though.
But the really important judgment comes from the jury. What is the court's verdict?
The jury returned at 5 minutes past one and returned into court at 25 minutes from two. In regard to the charge of murder, the jury, by a majority, find a verdict of not proven.
Not proven? That's a Scottish thing, isn't it, Denise?
It's an archaic Scottish finding for a court. So in this particular case, what they're saying is, you're guilty, but we can't find you legally liable for that because there isn't just enough evidence.
So it's part of the reason we're still talking about this case, because it never gets resolved. It's just sort of left open. And what was the conclusion of the court of public opinion?
The newspapers on this are quite interesting because a lot of the respectable press that's read by upper middle class people were very much in favour of this verdict. They thought it would allow her to get on with her life, even though she had made some kind of silly mistakes. The newspapers that were read more by working class people were less comfortable with this verdict. They raised the question of whether a working class girl in a similar situation to Madeleine would actually have been found guilty.
Now, this verdict, what impact did it have on the rest of Madeleine's life? Well, the fact that the verdict is unclear ends up being incredibly damaging. The conventional story is that she's forced to move to London, ends up in New York and dies there a pauper. Denise and Roz, is that your reading of the rest of Madeleine Smith's life?
I would have been more disappointed for Madeleine Smith if she had married Mr. Minnich and ended up a grandee of Scottish society. I mean, in some ways, this freed her of the shackles of societal expectation. So I do think it's the key to the door that lets her go off and have an interesting life.
Oh, wow. What do you think, Oz? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree. When Madeleine goes to New York, she takes a new name, she finds herself a much younger boyfriend, and her son and grandchildren live nearby. She has a great time. But when the press catch up with her, they reveal her identity and try to construct this cautionary tale to show that girls who have premarital sex and possibly kill their boyfriends don't get away with it.
So what does this case, in the end, tell us about Victorian society? I think that we tend to imagine Victorian women as being uptight and prudish, even sexless. And this was the ideology on the surface of the Victorian age. But despite the rhetoric, Madeleine Smith, for one, was clearly living a wild, full, sexually adventurous life. And in other important ways too. Madeleine's story is familiar to us today. This is a young woman who outgrows her first serious relationship, but the ex can't accept it's over. He does everything he can to keep her under his control. And when a woman's sex life is exposed to the public gaze, she never really escapes the public shame. Well, now it's goodbye. And it's thank you ever so much to Denise Miner and Rosalind Crone. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to Fall River, Massachusetts to hear about axe murderer Lizzie Borden. Or was she? It's still one of America's biggest unsolved cases. Don't miss an episode. Just search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Hannah Fisher. The music's composed by Asher Nathan, and the sound design is by Chris McLean. The readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's Adam Fleming. You might know me from Radio 4's Antisocial and the Newscast podcast. I wanted to tell you about a brand new podcast which has just launched. It's the story of Alexander Boris Dufefel Johnson, from boy to man to prime minister. In every episode, I'll speak to three guests, people who have known him, watched him, worked with him, dealt with him, fought with him, to reveal the moments that led to the creation of a politician known to so many people just as Boris. So that's the name of my new podcast, Boris. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.